On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush sat down at the White House last week with 10 former secretaries of state and defense to brief them on the war in Iraq. At the table, Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, the first woman to ever hold the post, and her mind must have been churning. In a new book on religion and foreign policy, Albright admits that she and Clinton insisted that the Balkans and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and even Al-Qaeda were not about religion. Now, some days under Bush, everything can seem to be about religion. A top Pentagon general says we must come against them in the name of Christ. Joining me now is Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001. She was Bill Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations from 93 to 97 and served on the National Security Council from 1978 to 81. She teaches now at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service in Washington, and she is author of the new book, The Mighty and the Almighty, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs. Madeleine Albright, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom.
You say that when it comes to religion, you made a mistake when you were in the Secretary of State's role. What was that?
Well, I am of the generation of people trained in international relations that would say, well, this conflict is complicated enough. Let's not bring God and religion into it because that always excites even greater passions. And so we tried very hard to try to solve issues without really bringing God and religion into it. And where I think we are is not that we should become solely focused on the idea of God and religion, and traditional diplomacy has to obviously continue to play a major role, but we need to understand much better the forces that are unleashed by God and religion and try to figure out how to find the moderating parts and the common parts within each religion to help us solve problems. I'm not a theologian, and I haven't turned into a religious mystic. I am still a problem solver, and so I'm looking at the role of God and religion in that perspective.
If you had seen the role of religion as more important in the 1990s, when you and Bill Clinton and that team were looking out on the world, what might you have seen that you missed? You're saying now it was a mistake not to be more cognizant of it, that you almost kept your conversations scrubbed of religion, even when they were in highly charged religious settings in the Balkan or the Al-Qaeda bombings in Africa. If you had let that come into the conversation and not just seen it as an issue of national interests, what might you have seen, Madeleine Albright, that you didn't?
Well, I think that, you know, we made a big point, as you point out, on after the bombings of the embassy to say this is not a religious issue, this is murder pure and simple, because we did not want to give justification to those who were doing it to say that they were doing it in the name of God. I think the place where it might have made a real difference is to do at the Camp David talks in the summer of 2000. Not that we were not aware of the role that religion played, because President Clinton especially, in the course of those talks, would sit and he read the Bible and the Quran and Torah and was obviously very familiar with all aspects of the Bible. But I think where we might have made a mistake is that Chairman Arafat was perfectly within his rights to make decisions about the size of a new Palestinian state. He was the duly elected leader, and that was something that he was entitled to do. Where he was, where we put him in a position that he could not make the decisions was over the dispositions of the holy places, because he is but was one person that had a connection to them, but other Arab leaders, Muslims, obviously also had a stake in the issue. And I think it would have been helpful had we brought some of them in much earlier in order to help Chairman Arafat make that decision. I'm not sure he could have anyway, but at least that's an example of something where I think that being more cognizant about the role of religion might have helped us.
And now you're looking out on the Bush administration, a period of American history in which religion has been very evident. We all recall, and you cite in the book, President Bush being asked whether his father would approve of the war against Iraq, and
George W. Bush said, you know, he's the wrong father to appeal to in terms of strength. There is a higher father I appeal to. And of course, earlier he had said to evangelicals, complicated context for this, but not that complicated, when he said, I believe God wants me to be president. You're saying the pendulum has swung far from where it was when perhaps you sold religion too short. Where do you see us having come today, Madeleine Albright?
Well, I think that there's no question, and certainly I have quotes such as the ones that you're mentioning in my book. But I have to be honest about something. I started this book out with the premise that George Bush was a complete anomaly in American history, the way that he related his actions to God. And then I went back, and I obviously studied American history many times in my education, but I hadn't really looked at it all through a religious prism. And we clearly are a country that was begun by people, religious people, escaping persecution. Then the whole concept of manifest destiny had a religious basis to it. Ultimately, you get somebody like President McKinley saying that it was his duty to Christianize the Philippines. So in that regard, George Bush is not out of the ordinary. Every American president has invoked God in some way, President Kennedy, President Roosevelt. So he's within that line. Where it is different, and it comes to the point that you've asked me, is President Bush's certainty that God is on our side. Not that we are on God's side, the way President Lincoln said, but a sense that God has blessed in some way what America is doing. And that leads to very serious issues in terms of definitions of good and evil, certainty about what our policy is, and turning his belief in religion into American policy rather than just being a matter of faith. And I worked for two very religious presidents, President Carter and President Clinton, but they did not make their faith American policy.
So what's the practical problem with it? It's very much there. We saw General William Boykin, of course, has been in the middle of that. He's now Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Warfighting. Was quoted saying once that the enemy will only be defeated if we come against them in the name of Christ. You can't bind national policy, the national face, much more closely to religion than that. What's the practical impact of that, Madeleine Albright?
Well, first of all, I think that was one of the most offensive statements, no matter what one's belief is, and one that really exacerbated the problems. And I frankly believe that he should not be continuing in positions of responsibility. But the issue, where it really comes down to in policy, is the following. When President Bush, after 9/11, I think unified the country in a completely brilliant way, and the choice was posed in the following way. It was us versus people who wanted to fly airplanes into buildings and kill innocent people. And so that the presentation of the choice in that way put many, all countries, on our side. But when given as a result of the president's view of good and evil, he says that the choice is the following, which is you have to agree with us on the war in Iraq, on Guantanamo, on Abu Ghraib, on our definition of American military power, and on America's general role in promoting democracy, then the number of countries that can line up with us diminishes. And then, if you are so certain about what you believe, you obviously don't test your assumptions enough. You don't listen to enough people. And the ultimate political and policy result is that when Plan A doesn't work, you don't have a Plan B. And so that's how it carries out into practical day-to-day policymaking.
So if you, by your own admission, made a mistake in not acknowledging religion enough in the 90s, if Bush, in your view, has brought it too front and center, you know, if we're going to err to one side, which way would you err?
Well, I am always for moderation. And so and this is what I would do is, first of all, I'd like to stress that I obviously am not moving away from traditional diplomacy. I think, however, it needs an assist. And in this particular way, what needs to happen is our diplomats have to have a much fuller understanding of the religious contexts within which they're operating. So that in addition to studying the languages and the history, culture of particular countries, they really need to know how religion is practiced, what the history of that is, what the different sects or divisions are. Then I also think that the Secretary of State should have a group of religious advisors, obviously of different religions or knowledgeable about them, because as Secretary of State, you don't know everything. And I had arms control advisors and economic advisors and environmental advisors who would be the ones that would set up the issues, do a lot of briefing, do a lot of background work, and then the Secretary of State can pick up the ball. So I would advise having religious advisors. And then the thing I would do is try to involve religious leaders in some of the conflict resolution, initially in trying to help to break down the issues, the problems into manageable bites. Then during the negotiations themselves, not necessarily sit at the table with the diplomats, but be there as resources and ultimately to be the validators.
It's a big, rich book. Lots of rooms in the mansion touched on here, Madeleine Albright, and a lot of current issues we want to speak about with you as well. But your fundamental critique goes so much to religion. I want to ask you about your own religious life, what it was like growing up. What is it today? And your well-known late life discovery that your family had been Jewish.
Well, I have a very confused religious life. I was raised a Roman Catholic. I married an Episcopalian and found out I was Jewish. So I have a lot of different ideas. And I definitely believe in God. But I have gone through a number of different iterations of thinking how to relate to God. I wrote in my memoirs and here that at a certain stage I thought I should be a Catholic priest, which certainly was not a credible idea. But I think that for me, one of the examples of why having had such a varied religious background is important because it leads to one of my conclusions in this book, which is that ultimately group labels do not work and you have to look at the role of the individual. So, but for choices made by my parents, I might have been going to a synagogue instead of a church. And then my father was a Czechoslovak diplomat who did not want to work for the communists when they took over in 1948. And we came to the United States. He asked for political asylum and I grew up an American. But for that shift, I might be a history professor at Charles University in Prague and been a Czech. So for me, the lesson out of this is that group labels are changeable or not that important, but the individual ultimately is. And frankly, there are a lot of people who say, well, really emphasis on the individual is a Western concept. And it's not a Western concept. It is basic in all three of the Abrahamic religions and in other religious philosophies. And so I think that that is one way that we can begin to look on how to solve problems and respect for each other because we are all created by God, however you believe in him.
So you embrace it at that large level, and yet you describe in the book coming face to face with a different kind of American attitude toward religion, as you were headed in as ambassador to the United Nations. Pat Robertson had a bestseller called The New World Order back in 1991, describing a plot to place a satanic dictator in charge of the whole world, controlling every aspect of human life, monitoring everybody by satellites. Freedom of religion would be abolished. Children would be indoctrinated from birth to obey wicked masters. Masters, this great Satan, essentially at the United Nations. You describe how you kind of fluffed this off as ridiculous, but learned that it was also a powerful perspective.
Well, it was that chapter is entitled The Devil and Madeleine Albright, and it really was a way that I was stunned at some of the things, especially the ones you describe, and that the Secretary General was the Antichrist and that there were all these plots going on. And what is interesting is the number of people who actually believe a great part of this, which then kind of melds into what are this whole rapture series and the books, The Left Behind, of people who look towards the end of the world and think that those people who believe in Christ will be magically taken to heaven while the rest of the people will rot. So I was very, very surprised and continue to be about the strength of that approach to religion.
But it's active. It's real. It's influenced American foreign policy, not to say domestic policy, in recent years. Was it a mistake for you to be that cut off from it? Is the Bush administration being driven by that perspective in some degree now?
Well, I can't say that, and I'm probably going to offend a lot of people when I say this, I can't say that I take any of that seriously, but it clearly plays an important role. I do not wish to believe that the Bush administration is driven by it in the following way, because part of the whole system of that belief is that the end of the world has to come. And then there are people within that group who think that things should be done in order to speed up the end of the world, which frankly would have an effect on policy if people took it seriously. I cannot believe that anybody in a decision-making role in Washington does take it seriously as a policy issue.
I want to listen to President Bush from his inaugural address, January 20th, 2005, if you could listen with us, Madam Secretary.
America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one. From the day of our founding, we have proclaimed that every man and woman on this earth has rights and dignity and matchless value because they bear the image of the maker of heaven and earth.
President Bush, in his last inaugural address, America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one. That's a very deep welding of religion and policy, at least to my ear. What do you make of that perspective?
Well, I think that it's rhetoric to a great extent and clearly is very expressive of the way that the president feels. But later in that speech, he says something which to me is more troubling. And I read from my book, he said that America in this young century proclaims liberty throughout the world and to all the inhabitants thereof. And then I say he might have added that in the Bible, God had assigned that same job in the same words to Moses. So this is really vintage George Bush. And to his admirers, it is viewed as being inspirational. And to his detractors, it's viewed as self-exalting. But it is a serious aspect of the way that the president views the role of the United States as having a mission to some extent of spreading democracy and Christianity, though he doesn't put it that particular way. But this mission aspect to it, I think, is something that is very central to the way that President Bush views American foreign policy.
You write in your book, you say, the Bush administration, despite major errors in judgment, is not engaged in a religious crusade. And then later you quote, and Bill Clinton has written a preface here, and you quote him at some length in a couple of sections, and you describe a telephone interview you had with the former president. He says that the question comes down to whether we are willing to admit that we are not in possession of the whole truth. That is, he said, the whole shooting match, the whole shebang. It's okay, says President Clinton, to say you believe your religion is true, even truer than other faiths, but not that you are in possession in this life of 100% of the truth. It seems to me that no small number of George Bush's supporters from the religious right do believe they have 100% of the truth.
You're right, and I think that that is what part of the problem is. I think my conversations with both President Carter and President Clinton were very clear on this subject, that it is essential to understand that you are not in possession of the whole truth, which allows you to have some doubt and also allows you to respect people who might have a different set of beliefs. President Clinton quoted the Apostle Paul from Corinthians in saying, I now see through a glass darkly, meaning that you don't know everything, and that ultimately it will be revealed. But to be on earth and as a mortal, to think that you have the ultimate truth, I think is one wrong, but self-righteous, and also does not allow for the useful exchange of ideas in order to solve problems. So I think it is troubling. I think it's very troubling that large numbers of Americans do believe in this aspect that they have the truth, because it's self-defeating in terms of trying to work your way out of a problem.
Madeleine Albright's new book is The Mighty and the Almighty. I want to turn to our listeners, if I may, from Waterloo, Iowa. Carol's on the line. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. I live in the Midwest. I'm not originally from here. And, you know, again, I don't want to offend anybody by saying that I'm not exactly comfortable with the religious influence. But seeing how it is so influential here and more so in our government policies, I'm wondering if Madeleine's opinion, what she thinks how we're modeling behavior as far as other countries' perspective. In other words, they're, you know, we condemn and take strong opinions about Islam and other things, but are we not modeling the very behavior that we seem to have these strong opinions about?
Madeleine Albright?
Well, I think that that's what's worrisome, is that by thinking that we're always right, we don't take into consideration enough of what's happening in other countries. And one of the very basic aspects of what I write about is it's important to know enough about your own faith to know what you believe in, but also a lot about somebody else's faith in order to be able to respect what they are thinking and doing. Now, for me, and I'm trying to see a positive side to the increased interest in religion, not only here but throughout the world, which is that while there are blood-curdling parts in all of the holy books, there also are very similar phrases and thoughts in all of them in terms of trying to find common ground on issues of social justice and peace, charity, the role of the individual. I think we can't deny the fact that religion, this is a very religious country, and that more people are of religion are influencing, and therefore we need to try to mitigate what are basically exclusivist views in all of the Abrahamic religions, not try to generalize off of some radical group, whether they're Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, and then say that the whole religion is like that, because we should not be judging Islam according to the terrorists, and we should not be judging Christianity according to the Ku Klux Klan or Judaism according to the man who assassinated Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. But there is, you have to be careful, as you point out, to not model and, you know, not transmit one's own thoughts about the correctness of religion and then denigrate somebody else's.
But who's modeling whom here? Carol wonders if the U.S. is now presenting a kind of a theocratic face to the world. You write how, of course, between your public positions, you've been in academia for a long time. You write about how when Samuel Huntington first came out with his Clash of Civilizations thesis, not long after the end of the Cold War, you and others thought, that's not a road we're going down. And yet today it can feel like we're very much on that road. So who's modeling the religious fervor here? Is American religiosity sort of breeding an equal and opposite reaction, as it were?
I think that's more than likely, though clearly American religiosity has been there for a long time. That's what I find so interesting, is that it's easy to make judgments about now, but the truth is that there has been a strand of this for a long time. But at the moment, and I think for great reason because of the spreading of modern technology that allows people with highly specific religious views to spread them through any kind of mode of information. I think there's more of it, and also because people are concerned. But I do think one can see an action-reaction. On the issue of the Clash of Civilizations, which I talk about, is it's a concept I don't want to accept, but I do think that we are involved in a battle of ideas, which is one reason that I think we need to be clearer about what we are for rather than just what we're against.
But President Bush seems pretty clear on that. He's for a lot of things, but among them, a Christian tradition.
Well, I mean, I speak more in terms of our understanding of what human rights is about, how we feel about the great divide between the rich and the poor, and not only in this country but throughout the world. And instead, what mostly I hear from the administration is who we're against, who's evil. That we have to be against the evildoers, and that we are the ones that are good, without a full explanation of that. And frankly, let's take, for instance, the letter that the Iranian president Ahmadinejad just sent to President Bush. It is full of invective and saber-rattling and lies. But it also does have some concepts in there that he's speaking to a large audience. It's not just to President Bush. I am not advocating that President Bush become a pen pal with him, but I do think that it's important for us at a very high level within the administration to give a speech which outlines how we feel about a number of these subjects to a much larger audience, rather than just saying this is our way or the highway.
Condoleezza Rice and the White House more or less blew that letter off. Do you think that was a mistake?
I do think it was a mistake. I think that, as I said, I don't think it needs to be answered word for word. But in diplomacy, you generally, if you're trying to find a solution, you look for entry points and you try to make your opportunities. And one of the, examples of this, although it's a different situation and goes back, is during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, President Kennedy chose to respond. There were two letters that were sent. He chose to respond to the one that offered some solution, not to the tough one. So I'm just saying that there are different ways to take a missive like this and try to find a way to use it positively. And what I would suggest is a speech that really puts forward some of our ideas in what I think is a battle of ideas.
Do you think if President Bush gave such a speech, given his proclivity, would that win people over, or would it push them deeper into their Islamic camp or whatever it might be? Would it be so imbued with the religion, the language of Christianity, that it might exacerbate rather than open a door of shared understanding?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you'd have to, I really would hope that by now his speechwriters would understand that some of the language that has been used, like the axis of evil and the language that you're talking about, has not helped the situation.
We're talking this hour with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, the first female U.S. Secretary of State. Her new book is The Mighty and the Almighty, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs. Liz is on the line from Roslindale, Massachusetts. Hi, Liz, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I find this whole tendency absolutely terrifying and deeply offensive, actually, as well. First of all, whatever happened to the quaint notion of separation of church and state? Second, not only are we now all supposed to be religious, but we're supposed to be Christian. And as a Jew, a secular Jew at that, I find that deeply offensive. Third, evangelical Christians believe that they're the only ones who are going to go to heaven. Everyone else of us is going to hell. And I don't see how you can ever, I think I'm sort of echoing Madeleine Albright here, how you could ever have a dialogue with other people if you think that the devil has a hold on them and they're all doomed to hell. So to me, this trend is absolutely terrifying and very, very upsetting.
There's a lot right there. Madeleine Albright, please respond to Liz.
Well, I think there is a lot that is terrifying in it. And I think those of us that are just recognizing the fact that religion does have an effect have to keep repeating that the basis of our country is a separation of church and state. And I think that is a very clear aspect of how we work. But I think the issue really is that, as I said earlier, you can't separate people from their faith. And so the question is how to mitigate the worst aspects, as you point out, that make people of one faith decide that the others, I'm right, you're wrong, go to hell. So that, I think, is where the real issues come down, and whether there's any way to fix that. And that's all I'm arguing, is that we have to try to figure out, with the help of moderate religious people, how to push back on what are clearly very offensive kinds of ideas where one group of people exalts themselves over somebody else.
And it's become a very public thing. You talked about the founders, but then you quote George Washington saying, the foundation of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality. Morality is very public these days.
Well, there's a difference. You know, I argue for the fact that the U.S. should have a moral foreign policy, which means that we ought to try to help the poor, work on human rights issues, develop ideas of social justice, not a moralistic foreign policy where we go around hectoring and telling everybody what to do according to the way that we see things. Those are two quite different aspects.
Madeleine Albright, we've got the philosopher Daniel Dennett calling in from Medford, Massachusetts, a professor at Tufts, written recently a lot about religion and its opposite. Daniel Dennett, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was fascinated with what Madeleine Albright said about the rapture people, the left behind believers who might be in the administration. And she said she couldn't believe that they were actually influencing policy, that they were actually deciding policy on the basis of their belief in the rapture. Well, I found that a sort of ominous phrase. I want to know what her incredulity is based on. Is it based on evidence? Has she checked? Is there anybody that's looking to see how influential these views are in this administration? Or is it just that she just hates to believe it and doesn't dare look?
Ambassador Albright?
Well, that's a very good question. I guess, to be fair, I hate to believe it. What I find interesting, there are people who have analyzed various speeches that the president gives and says that they are full of kind of code words to the far right. I'm not an expert on that. I certainly have seen those articles. I find it, frankly, too hard to believe that there are responsible people trying to bring about the end of the world in order to fulfill their beliefs. Because let me just say this, is people that have never had high-level government jobs don't know how hard they are, and people like me who've left them have forgotten. And I try really hard to say that people in their offices are not sitting there trying to make bad decisions. But I guess my real issue is that I just find it impossible to believe that anybody who has the responsibility of the United States in their hands would be deliberately working towards the end of the world.
Daniel Dennett?
Well, she herself said that these people are arrogant in their belief, or that they have this self-righteous overconfidence. Somebody who actually believes that this is the way to go would presumably put this ahead of their loyalty to the United States.
Madeleine Albright,
you find that so hard to believe?
You quote President Bush at one point here, talking about why the U.S. did not go into Iraq with a bigger coalition. And the president said, at some point, we may be the only ones left. That's okay with me. We are America. Now, that's not necessarily rapture thinking, but there is a kind of anointed quality to that perspective there that I wonder if it doesn't mitigate against working with others or believing that, you know, we're so blessed that all alone we can do whatever's required.
Well, I think there is this kind of self-righteous aspect to that. And one of the questions about leaders is that you do want leaders that have a certain amount of self-confidence and that are capable of stating the issue in a way that rallies support. What you don't want are leaders that are self-righteous. And there's a very fine line in that. I found We Are America, the way that it was framed, I think made it a very difficult issue for people to support us. And so as a practical policymaker, I thought it was a counterproductive phrase. Now, there is something, and I believe in this. America is an exceptional country. I'm an immigrant. I had the opportunity to grow up a free American, and whether one reads the New Testament or come read it in Spider-Man, to whom much is given, much is expected. And I do think that the U.S. has a role because we are so rich, to be helping other countries, and there is something special. The problem with the way that it's framed by President Bush and his people is that not only that they think we have a special mission and are exceptional, but that exceptions should be made for us. And that's what I find so unacceptable, because it puts us out of the realm of cooperating with others and then deciding that what we say is right is right. But to go back to this original point, I think that the people in the Bush administration believe that what they're doing is right for America. I cannot believe that they actually are working to bring about the end of the world. I really cannot find that plausible, or maybe it's just that I would find it so impossible that kind of people operate in our day and age. But I can understand why people are worried, given the number of people that do believe in the rapture, and still, for instance, the number of people who are willing to believe that there was a connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein.
You were just in the White House last week, Madeleine Albright, for a progress report from President Bush and some of the top administration officials there. What did you hear in that briefing? You and I guess it was 10 former secretaries of state and defense. Did you hear, as he reported on Iraq, did you hear missionary zeal? Did you hear a cooler realism at work?
Well, it was very different from the first meeting that we had in January, where I think we were all supposed to just be potted plants. But I had decided that I'd criticize the president publicly, and it would be intellectually dishonest not to say what I think, which is what I did. And I did again in this meeting. I didn't see missionary zeal, but I did have a sense that even as we were briefed about what was going on in Iraq, both politically and militarily, that there continues to be a view that this is all going to turn out all right and that we're doing the right thing. They handed out kind of a brochure which showed all the various successes that had taken place, and that there is a myopic approach or a desire to interpret the facts in a way that would make people think that that we were going in the right direction.
Condoleezza Rice, the current Secretary of State, studied in part at the elbow of your father. I think he was her thesis advisor. Do you see her turning the nation's foreign policy toward a more the school of realism more than her predecessors? Do you see the complexion changing under Ms. Rice?
Well, I think that what has happened is that there has been a learning curve in this administration. And some of that is as a result of the facts that we can't operate without the help of other countries. I don't find this division always between realism and idealism useful, because I could never figure out where I fit in, because I'd say I was a realistic idealist or an idealistic realist. But I do think that Secretary Rice is using diplomacy more, but you know, I think the thing we have to remember is she has been a part of this administration from the very beginning, and clearly an architect of various aspects of this policy. But I do think that she is seeing the value of diplomacy in a way. Certainly Secretary Powell saw the value of diplomacy, but it was during the first term there was much more emphasis on the value of the military.
Ed is calling from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was wondering what the Secretary thought about the idea that there is a world perception that Israel is a theocracy and receives their national mandate from God, not just the United Nations in 1948, and that in order to be a full citizen, you must be Jewish. And I was wondering if she believes that perhaps our inability or our ability to settle this Mideast crisis has been compromised by our staunch support of a theocracy on one side and insisting on the Palestinians to be completely secular. It seems to be a double standard.
Madeleine Albright.
Well, I think that clearly the United States has been linked with the independence of Israel from the very beginning, President Truman being the first one to recognize Israel as a state. And We believe that it is in our interest that Israel be secure and a democracy within the Middle East. I think that there is very much this is where I came down originally on this question, is that if, for instance, Jerusalem was just a real estate issue, it would have been resolved a long time ago. But because both sides actually believe that that little piece of land was given to them by God, that's what complicates it, and that's why in some way you have to bring religion in. I think that our insistence on what is happening with the Palestinians is not so much that they be secular, but that Hamas not use violence as its tool. And I don't think we have a problem dealing with countries that are Islamic. For instance, one of our very good relations are with Turkey, which is an Islamic country, or with Indonesia, which is an Islamic country. And so that isn't the problem. I think the problem is more how violence is used and how discriminatory a country is in terms of rights towards others. And obviously, I personally have some questions about how non-Jews are treated in Israel, for instance, some of the Arab population now. But I think the main thing at the moment with Hamas is the fact that it will not give up its use of violence as a tool.
Looking here on Ed's point in your book, though, I see when you try and weigh out whether religion is ultimately more effective toward peace or toward conflict, you write, two ideas have proved particularly troublesome. The first is the claim made by some extreme Zionists and backed by many Christians that God's gift of land to Israel provides a license to ignore Palestinians' rights. You said against that the Islamic notion that, as Khaled El-Fadl has written, any territory that has ever been ruled by Muslims remains forever a part of the abode of Islam. That's pretty deep-rooted religious perspective on both sides there.
Well, it certainly is stated by those people, but there are others within the both religions that, in fact, do see the possibility of some compromise. The question is how we all manage to work with those within all the religions that have views that would allow for compromise, that coming from those who actually have some doubt that they have the full answer, versus the exclusivists. And one of the hardest parts about this discussion are the labels here.
Mm-hmm.
But those who are very determined in what it is they believe that would allow no compromise. But I believe that within the religions, there are those who can understand that there is room for compromise. But the statements that you point out, which I wrote, definitely underline that we're not dealing with anything that is easy to resolve. And I'm not arguing all of a sudden that I've got some panacea. I am just looking for ways that various aspects of religion, once we understand that none of the three religions is monolithic, that there are those within it who can have interpretations that would allow for compromise.
You quote Paul Tillich, the theologian, doubt is not the opposite of faith, it is an element of faith. But is there a point at which we do, in fact, get locked into a clash of civilizations? Are we there?
I don't think we are there, because this is not a matter of one civilization against another. I think there are different concepts that where there are many arguments. One could also make the argument that it is a clash between the civilized and the uncivilized, because deciding to fly airplanes into buildings and kill innocent people and suicide bombers is not civilized. So I refuse to buy the fact that all of Islam is warlike and anti-Christian and Jewish, because there have, in fact, one, have certainly been periods in history where the three religions got along. Also, within each religion, there are those who have a sense that they can get along. I had the most fascinating meeting with three current religious leaders, Rabbi David Saperstein, Imam Faisal, who has a very large following in the eastern part of the United States, and Richard Land from the Southern Christian group. And they found a number of issues that they could agree on, And talked about the fact that every religion is a many splintered thing and that we should be looking for ways to work together.
Madeleine Albright, you give us hope and something to fear at the same time. The new book is The Mighty and the Almighty. Madam Secretary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.